quarantine is messing with my days. All the days are blending together.
All the days are the same.
Had to remind myself like 5 times today that it was Saturday because all my days look alike.
So. Yeah, this morning when I woke up, I wanted to clock in. I was like, no, I'm not working.
That's what I kept having to remind myself today, is that I don't have to clock in tomorrow because it's Sunday. Oh, what is the world right now?
I know.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of State of Murder.
Woohoo! I believe we're on episode 10.
Yes, episode 10. We made it 10 episodes, 10 states down.
I know. After today, 40 more to go.
Yep. And we're making our way further and further through the country. Yeah, further east down the country.
Yep. So I know my dad sent an email to his siblings talking about our podcast because he finally listened to a episode. So he listened to our New Mexico episode.
Okay.
So
what did he think?
He didn't tell me. But he did send an email to his brothers and his sister stating that they should listen. But then it wasn't like, oh, it was good. But like him trying to describe how to find it over email, like this 75-year-old man. I think he called it a web pod. A webcam? I don't know.
That's funny.
Oh, it was.
Hey, getting the word out there. We now have listeners.
The word out to people 70 years and older.
Nice. Yeah, and we have listeners from across the pond over there in England now. We have Swedish listeners. I believe we have Canadian listeners, which is awesome. So hi to all of you guys. We hope you're enjoying what you're hearing.
Hello, I believe it's the Keys that listen from they're called the Keys. They're a family I know in Canada.
Okay, hi.
I'm guessing. Hi. Shout out to all of our listeners. I was pleasantly surprised at how many European countries we were getting.
Yeah, that's awesome though. So hopefully after we cover the 50 states, maybe before we backtrack, we can hit some international locations. So yeah, if you're from another country, please feel free to let us know if you have any cases that you want us to discuss or study. We'd love to research things outside of the United States. So send us your emails at stateofmurderpodcast@gmail.com. All right. So today we are in the state of Wyoming.
Wyoming.
Yeah. Have you been to Wyoming before?
Of course I have. I've been to Wyoming multiple times.
Of course you have.
So I've been to Yellowstone. When I was growing up, my best friend, Kathleen, her extended family is from Montana, but we went to Wyoming to Yellowstone Park a couple of times.
Okay. So,
yeah. I've been there. I've also driven through it. So
nice.
That's exactly what you picture, kind of just there.
Yeah. John's been to Yellowstone too. My husband's been to Yellowstone. I think he went to Wyoming. So he's been to Wyoming. I have not been to Wyoming.
One of the Coopers. One of the Coopers has traveled.
One of the Coopers has traveled way more places than the other. Because we're still holding out for that other state that I've been to. So because it is not Wyoming.
We'll get to it.
We'll get there. We'll get there. All right. So yeah, so we have two brand new cases for you guys this week. So Amber, you want to tell us your case?
Sure. So today I'm going to tell you guys about Alice and Gerald Uden. So I really, really struggled with how to tell you guys the story about Alice and Gerald. It's kind of interweaving and like, I just really struggled with it. So we're even recording a day later than we normally do because I just couldn't write this up. I just really had a hard time.
Okay.
So just let everybody know that. But I decided to start it by telling you guys that there were two separate true crime stories about missing persons. So the first person to go missing was Ronald Holtz. He went missing sometime in December of 1974. The second is a missing family. Virginia and her two sons, Reagan and Richard, went missing on September 12, 1980. These missing person cases would start to unfold with the discovery of a body that the Laramie County Police had been searching for over 40 years. On August 27th, 2013, after searching an old mine shaft located on Remount at, or not on, I guess, at Remount Ranch. So they searched for over 5 years in the mines. So they found the body of Ron Holtz. He was discovered about 40 feet down the shaft. So they had a hard time because there were a lot of different kinds of bones in the shaft. Like, I guess, I don't know. They
like animals get down there or what?
They found cows and horse bones and stuff.
Oh, so, my God.
I don't know what that's about. So I don't know if like, if they die, they just like, it's easier to just drag them and throw them down a mine shaft, or did these animals go there and fall down a mine shaft? I mean, interesting fact, my dad almost died falling down a mine shaft once, kind of cave thing. So
I'm sure
they're dangerous and everything. So it took 5 years to kind of sift through all of the rubble, but they discovered his body. And the autopsy would show that he had been shot in the head with a .22 caliber bullet. So police didn't have to do a lot of investigating to figure out who could have possibly murdered Holtz, because they already knew who had killed him. They just needed his body to be able to make their arrest. So in 1989, a witness came forward sharing that they knew that Holtz was dead, and that it was his wife, Alice, who had shot him. So how did this witness know that? That's because Alice told them. So Alice also mentioned this to her son, Todd, that she had killed Holtz. Todd reported that he had told many people about this. So including like, I think somebody, like his boss or somebody, and multiple police stations for multiple years that his mom had killed her husband. But wow. I don't know why they didn't quite respond to that in a timely manner. It would take over 15 years before from 1989, it would take 15 years before the police started actively investigating and looking into Holtz's disappearance.
So, did it say if they got like a new piece of evidence that drove that, or?
No, it, like that's the one thing, it kind of glossed over. I mean, lesser known cases. So it glosses over some of what I would find interesting and wanting to know. So I just said, 89, this happened. And then in 2005, they started to actually investigate. And so they first started interviewing Alice Uden, who was Holtz's wife at that time. So Alice shared about her life, telling the investigators about her two other marriages and all about her children and her life. But never once did she mention that she knew Holtz or was ever even married to Holtz. So just like he didn't even exist in her mind.
Okay.
When the investigators came back the next day, they confronted her about why she hadn't mentioned Holtz when they were questioning her. Mm-hmm. Alice stated that she hadn't been married to him for very long, and then she didn't even really consider it a real marriage. So police left with no answers from Alice. It would take 8 years later that they would be at Alice's door again, but this time to arrest her.
Yeah, what a weird thing. Like, oh, it's so short, I don't even consider it a marriage. Like,
yeah.
So you made the decision to marry someone.
We'll get into that. Alice is an interesting lady. I actually don't know a lot about Alice's history growing up. I believe she was born in Denver in 1939, but she was raised mostly in Illinois. Her first marriage was to a cop. She married him really young. And she had 4 kids before the age of 20.
Oh my goodness.
So she was popping out the kids.
And this one was in after the 80s?
No, this would have been in the 60s.
The 60s. Okay.
Yeah.
But still, my God, that's so many kids.
Yes.
So young.
So she had 4 children with her first husband, and then they got divorced. So I'm not quite sure what year they got divorced. I just know that they got divorced. She then married again to Don Prunty. He was a World War II vet who drifted from job to job. So he reportedly died from alcoholism, which left her with a lot of debt and a brand new baby to take care of. So now she has 5 children. So she has her kids from her first marriage, and then now she has a brand new baby.
Okay.
So after the death of her husband, she had numerous jobs to keep herself afloat. So she was like a barmaid. Then she became a bus driver. And then she became a nurse for a small town psychiatric hospital. Now, it didn't say that she went to school to be a nurse, so I don't really know. But so it just sounds like a job that she picked up.
Huh. Interesting.
So during that time that she was kind of floating around between jobs, she would send her kids whenever she felt overwhelmed and didn't have enough money to live with her family back east so that she wouldn't have to take care of them. So in 1974, while she was working at the psychiatric hospital, she would meet Ronald Holtz. He was a patient there.
Oh, okay.
So Alice stated that Holtz had been a door gunner in Vietnam. I don't know what a door gunner is. I imagine it's
that you would work the gun outside
from a door.
So yes, a crewman tasked with firing and maintaining armament aboard a helicopter.
Okay. I can picture that. Like I can, I
that
mean,
makes it's sense.
From Forrest Gump, but I picture that like
the picture.
So that, you know, everything's movies for me.
Everything.
So he was a door gunner in Vietnam, but had been kicked out of the army because, as Alice says, he was nuts. So while she was working and caring for the patients at the hospital, she fell in love with Holtz. You know, that old kind of Joker and
Harley Quinn
story there.
And we all know how detrimental that is.
So they ended up running away from the hospital and got married. Alice knew it was totally wrong to fall in love with a patient, but she just didn't care. So the two rented a trailer house in Cheyenne, and Holtz drove a cab to make money to support the family. And she said he also supported his habits. So she thought he was using drugs and stuff, but I don't know proof of that. So Alice reported that he was very, very violent and had started to beat her after they got married, and that he would threaten her baby girl whenever her baby would cry. So remember, she had that little baby. Mm-hmm. And then he told her that he had killed babies in Nam and he'd kill that baby too. So he kept threatening to kill her daughter.
Okay.
Yeah. So he sounds, if all of this is true. So we're getting this all like every time we share about information, a lot of times it comes from certain sources. So this comes from Alice herself. So
yeah,
who really knows if all of this is true, but we're just going to take it like it is. Like we're just going to tell it how she said it happened. So one night around Christmas time in 1974, they had been married for about 5 months. So not a long marriage. So there you go. So she said it wasn't a very long marriage. So according to Alice, Ronald went berserk that night, and Alice knew that she had to kill him before he killed her and her baby.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's like, okay, that went from 0 to 60 pretty fast. Alice had two different accounts of the story of what happened that night. There was the story that she told her friends and her son, and then there's the story that she told the cops. So first, she told her friends and her son that she just shot him in the head while he was sleeping on the bed one night.
That doesn't sound like self-defense.
No. So then her police story states that they'd gotten into this fight and he was leaning over the baby's crib to harm the baby. And so she had no other choice. So she ended up shooting him in the head. Okay. So Alice stated that after she shot him, she then drove her daughter to Colorado to stay with Holtz's mother. So not only, so she kills Holtz, then takes her daughter, who's not even his daughter, to be like cared for by his mom so that she can dispose of the body.
Oh my God.
So she drives to Colorado, leaves her baby with his mother. She then returns to the trailer, puts his body into a cardboard storage barrel, loads it up into her car, which I am like really impressed that she's able to do this on her own, because a dead body is really hard to move.
Yeah.
And put it in this cardboard barrel and then load it into her car. She then drove it to the ranch that she had used to work at with her second husband and dropped it down the mine shaft. She then packed up all of her stuff and moved out of town before anybody could miss either of them. Now, normally that would be the end of one of our stories. However, the story of Alice isn't done yet. So okay. Once Alice has moved, she found a new town in Wyoming. So she ended up moving her trailer to Lander, Wyoming, where she would meet Gerald Uden. So Gerald was born in a small town in Nebraska. So shout out Nebraska. It was actually Harvard, Nebraska. He was really, really close with his family and spent a lot of time growing up with his grandparents on the farm. Gerald was honorably discharged from the Navy after spending 4 years on the USS Independence. So I can't remember what they said he did on the USS Independence, but he didn't think it was too exciting. So yeah, I think he was listening into stuff. Like, I don't know. So when he got out of the Navy, his parents had left Nebraska and moved to Lander, Wyoming. So in the summer of 1964, Gerald followed his parents to Wyoming, hoping to either find a job or a wife.
Okay.
Those are the choices, right? The 60s, I guess. I don't know. Or maybe a job and a wife would be good. So Gerald really enjoyed fixing things, fishing, and he was really knowledgeable and enjoyed guns. So once Gerald had moved to Lander, he got a job working at the U.S. Steels. I don't know what this is. I'm going to pronounce it Taco Night because that's how it's spelled.
Like a literal, like a taco?
Yeah, T-A-C-O-N-I-T-E, mine. So I don't know what that is, if that's like a mineral or whatever. But anyway, he got a job at the U.S. Steel's Taco Night mine. So his job there was to be like fix the equipment. So he kind of was like the handyman.
Okay.
So in 1965, Gerald would meet his first wife, Barbara Ann. They got divorced in 1968. So,
okay.
He got married again in 1973 to a lady named Wanda. But they were only married for 6 weeks before she left him. So all Gerald wanted and dreamed of was having a family. Then one day there was a knock on the door, and when he answered it, there stood a woman named Virginia. She had heard that he knew a lot about guns, and she wanted to know if her old 22 caliber rifle was worth any money. So when Gerald told her that it wasn't worth much because pieces weren't original on it, she was really sad because she was really struggling for money as she had been recently divorced and had two young boys to raise. So Gerald felt really sorry for her and invited her and her boys out for dinner. The next weekend, Gerald then drove over to Hudson, which is a town pretty close to Lander, where Virginia lived with her sons, Richard, who was 6, and Reagan, who was 4. Virginia shared with Gerald that her ex-husband kept missing his child support payments and that she was struggling with handling the boys because they were very rowdy. So in the books and articles I read about this, they said that they thought that the two boys probably had ADHD, but it wasn't diagnosed back then as readily as it is now. And so Virginia was really, really overwhelmed with parenting and she really didn't enjoy being a mom that much. I don't know if that's true, but she just really struggled with being a mom. So, I mean, being single and not really having like steady income and having a ex-husband that's not paying any child support would probably be pretty hard. So she told Gerald all of this, that her ex-husband kept missing all the payments, that she was struggling handling the boys. Soon, Virginia and Gerald started dating. They seemed to enjoy the same stuff. So they both liked being outdoors, hunting, fishing, and shooting stuff.
Okay.
My idea of hell. So, and the boys really blossomed under when like Gerald was around. They really liked having him kind of the man about the house, and he took them hunting and fishing. So Virginia finally introduced Gerald to her mother, Claire, and Claire really liked Gerald because she thought he was kind of like a steady influence on her. He had a job, he was supportive, you know, he looked after, and he really liked the boys. So after a very short time of dating, on July 3rd, 1974, Gerald and Virginia got married. Gerald moved into their house, and it seemed like they had a really happy family, a family that Gerald had always wanted. So it didn't take very long for Richard and Reagan to start calling him dad, which he just thought was the greatest thing ever. That's all because he's always wanted to be a dad. So in March of 1975, Gerald ends up adopting the two boys because he wants to take responsibility for them. He puts them like on his insurance. He knew that their dad, they didn't really know their biological dad at all. So they, it was kind of an easy fit. The biological dad signed away his rights. So he was like, okay. And then to celebrate, they ended up doing in the summer of 1975, going on a family trip to Pennsylvania to go visit Virginia's kind of estranged father. So kind of a weird celebration family trip when you don't really know him.
Yeah.
Kind of weird. When it was time to return back to Wyoming after visiting for a couple of weeks, Virginia decided that she wanted to stay there for a while with the boys. So she ended up buying Gerald a plane ticket and just kind of telling him, hey, I'm staying here. Go ahead and go back home. So Gerald headed back because he had to go to work, but kept sending them money. So he thought that they would come back in a couple weeks. It took them longer than that. So like the summer starts wrapping up. He's really missing them. So in September, he finally calls Virginia and tells her that she needs to come back home because school has started for the boys and they're missing it. And she just needs to be home. So he demands that she come back. So she and the children return, but she is no longer the wife that he had married. So she was really kind of aloof. She didn't want him touching her. It's totally different than when they had months before when he had left her. Yeah. And then the kids were no longer calling him dad. They're calling him Gerald. So he had no idea what had changed. Like he hadn't changed. He was the same guy. She just totally flipped like on him. Yeah. And so after she returns, so she's there for a little bit. Virginia just springs it on him and tells him she wants a divorce. So he ended up hooking up his old trailer and moving back to Lander. Gerald didn't know what had changed with his relationship, but he didn't really put up a fight. He was just like, okay.
Yeah. So you're going to make that choice then.
Yeah. So he agreed though to leave her with a lot of this belongings and stuff. And he agreed to keep the boys on his insurance and that he would send child support every month and still take care of business. So he kind of sounded like he was kind of trying to be upstanding and still be the dad, even though he wasn't biological, but he had adopted him. So he was trying to do the right thing. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't very long after he moved back to Lander that he got a new neighbor that parked her trailer right beside him. So on July 7th, 1976, there was another knock on his door and the trailer park manager was there with a woman who had two kids with her, a toddler and a teenager. So they needed a man's help to help fix their trailer because they couldn't plug in. I guess they had like 110 volt plug in. So, and they needed the cord to be a 220 volt plug in to be able to connect it. But they didn't want to hire an electrician because it was going to be expensive and she didn't have any money. So they knew, they knew Gerald was kind of a handyman. Kind of reminds me of the episode of Bob's Burgers this last week with Teddy. Like, he's not a licensed electrician, but he can get some stuff done.
There you go.
So, this woman was Alice. Gerald found out that he and Alice had a lot in common. They both liked the outdoors, and they both liked to fish.
I guess that's enough.
So, Alice told Gerald her life story the first time they went fishing, and Gerald knew from that moment that she was the woman for him.
Oh my God.
They started dating, and about 2 weeks after his divorce from Virginia was final, he wed Alice on November 5th, 1976.
Okay.
This man really wants to be married.
He does.
Like, he doesn't date him long. They marry real quick. So, whatever. So, Alice got a job at a local hospital, and they were doing fine. So, everything was going really good. Except for Gerald remembers one incident when they were attending a New Year's party at the local hospital where Alice worked, and Gerald ran into his ex-wife, Barbara Ann. Alice ended up interrupting their talking and stated, "Who the hell does she think she is? Old lovers don't come back. Old affairs should never be discussed, and ex-wives should disappear for forever."
Okay, so, calm down.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's some jealous tendencies right there.
Yeah. Oh my God. Like, did he just talk to her or was she just happened to be there?
Yeah, so she just came
up and
was kind of, they, I guess, were reminiscing about old times. So, like, this has probably been 10 years since they had been married. And
oh my goodness. You know,
just kind of was like, okay. And yeah. So Gerald, I mean, otherwise, like, their relationship was pretty good. They had no issues. Gerald kept paying child support to Virginia and had unrestricted visits with the boys. However, Alice really didn't like that. So keep in mind, she don't like the exes. So his visits with the boys started to taper off. And then he even got to the point where if he saw them like across the street or anything, he wouldn't even acknowledge that he knew them if Alice was there.
Okay.
Yeah. After the divorce, floated around moving from the West Coast to the East Coast, switching jobs a lot. But in June of 1978, she ended up moving to New Jersey. However, she couldn't get a job and was getting really increasingly frustrated with Gerald as she thought that he and Alice were purposely messing with her son's medical insurance. So remember, Gerald was like, I'll pay their child support and I'll keep them on my work insurance. Mm-hmm. And so Richard, the oldest boy, had a lot of medical issues. It didn't say specifically what, but I know like he had some like eye issues and just a whole bunch of stuff. And so every time she went to the doctor, there was like issues with the insurance. So Virginia started calling Gerald and writing letters demanding more child support and help with fixing the insurance issues. Mm-hmm. But instead of hearing from Gerald, Virginia heard from Alice.
Of course.
So Alice is the one who responded to the end with the letters, sending her own letters. So in the spring of 1979, she wrote back stating that she thought Virginia was brainless. She had no backbone or guts to stand on her own two feet and take care of her children herself. She dubbed Virginia a con artist who tricked Gerald into adopting her sons and then just so that he would have to pay for them, which, I mean, kind of sounds like that did happen, because like as soon as he adopted them, totally changed according to him.
Yeah.
But, you know, so it's like, okay, I can see that, why she would kind of say that. Alice wrote again in January of 1980, but this time her tone changed a little bit, and she asking if Gerald could start seeing the boys again, because they hadn't really had any visits for a little while. So Virginia kind of at her wit's end on what to do, because Alice just kept kind of bombarding her with stuff. Because then again, Alice and Gerald send her another letter when they didn't get a response from her, stating that he was going to take her to court and try to get custody of the boys, because it sounded like Virginia wasn't doing her job as a parent. So Virginia was kind of like at her wit's end. She had so much on her plate. She decided she was going to return to Wyoming at the end of the school year. So this was in 79. No, sorry. This was in 1980. So the summer of 1980, Virginia ended up moving back to Wyoming and moving in with her mother, Claire. So Gerald's visits resumed with the boys, and they ended up spending nights with Gerald and Alice. But like one of the things Virginia wanted to do was actually meet Alice, because she'd never met this lady, right? So all she's ever gotten are these kind of nasty, scathing letters from Alice.
Yeah.
So she just wanted to meet the lady that was married to Gerald and kind of caring for her sons when they would go spend the night. And Gerald was totally refused, saying that she did not need to meet Alice, that she knew Gerald and that was good enough. Kind of just like, absolutely not.
Okay.
So Virginia kept asking Gerald for more money because Richard continually kept getting ill and the hospital bills were piling up. So on September 11th, 1980, Gerald called up Virginia and offered to take the boys bird hunting the next day as he had the day off. They arranged to meet, and Gerald asked her to bring the .22 rifle that she had showed him on the day that they had met for the boys to use. So then the next day, on September 12th, 1980, that morning, Virginia ended up calling her lawyer to draw up new child support papers, and the boys overheard her on the phone, and they got really, really upset because they wanted to go hunting, and they knew she would probably bring it up when they met Gerald, and that they would fight, and then that they probably wouldn't get to go hunting. So they're like, no, Mom, don't even bring it up. Don't worry about it. We just want to have a good time hunting with our dad. So the other person who also heard this was Claire, her mom. So Claire was also like, don't fight with him. Just drop the boys off. Let them go hunting. So Claire let Virginia borrow her county squire station wagon, and they drove off to meet Gerald that day. And Claire would never see her daughter or grandsons again. So nobody would know what happened to Virginia, Richard, and Reagan for 33 years.
Oh my goodness.
So, yeah. So during Alice's interrogation by the police about her murder of Ronald Holtz, after she was arrested, Alice would point the finger at Gerald and share that he had shot all three of them in 1980. So he shot Virginia, Reagan, and Richard in 1980. So right after Alice was arrested, Gerald was also brought in for questioning regarding his ex-wife and two sons. Gerald ended up confessing to killing all three. So,
but did he do it though, or did she do it? And he's covering for her.
Well, I don't know.
So, okay, keep going.
So he stated that when Virginia met him that day to go hunting, he ended up getting in the car and had her drive about 5 miles from 5 miles from the
just five Chads all lined up a row
that distance. So about 5 miles away. He then had them all get out, and he told the boys that he needed to, I guess this rifle you had to put together, I don't know, the 22 rifle, it was from the Great Depression era.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know about older guns.
You know
guns.
Me, we've already established this, folks, that I don't know nothing about no guns. So he ended up he had to put it together, and then he wanted to test fire it to make sure that it worked before they started shooting the gun. So Gerald test fired a couple of times into the ground. And while that was going on, Virginia had her back to him looking across the road. So he ended up walking up to her, putting the muzzle of the gun to her back of her head and fired. He then turned and shot Richard behind his left ear. And Reagan witnessed his brother being shot, took off screaming towards the canal. When he reached the water, he stumbled and fell into the water. And while he was scrambling to get up, Gerald followed right behind him, stretched out his arm, and shot him behind the ear as well.
Oh my God.
Gerald shoved their bodies back into the station wagon. When he got back to his place, he loaded them to the back of his truck. So he drove to like his family's trailer park, loaded them to the back of his pickup truck, put them in empty oil drums, weighed them down so that they would sink, took them on his boat, and dropped them off in deep part of Fremont Lake is where he says that he put them. So,
wow.
Yeah. He then also took the station wagon, and he noticed that there was like a whole bunch of Virginia's blood in it. And so he like graffitied it a whole bunch, and then he tried to drop it down a cliff, but it got stuck on a tree. And so it was found a couple of days later. When Claire, and then Claire had reported her daughter and grandson's missing.
Mm-hmm.
So Gerald stated that he did this, like he killed him because he wanted to solve the problem of Virginia. So that's how he stated it, that problem of Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
That he had saved himself $14,000 in child support by killing the two boys, and that he guaranteed Alice would stay with him forever now that Virginia had disappeared like ex-wife should. So remember that statement she made when Barbara Ann came, that ex-wives just needed to disappear. So he apparently made that happen.
Okay,
so Alice,
yeah. Okay. But to me, it's like, why'd you have to kill the kids? Because you guys could have just taken care of them, because she has a bunch of kids. And
yeah,
so
but I don't think Alice liked those kids.
Oh, because they weren't her kids?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
And they weren't his kids either. So...
Yeah, but, I mean, I guess that's
like
true.
Not her biological kids, but
mm-hmm.
So I don't know. So Alice was found guilty of second degree murder of Holt and given 20 years. However, she died in 2019 at the age of 80. So she was like 73 when she was arrested for the murders. And then Gerald ended up pleading guilty to first degree murder in the fall of 2013. And was given a life sentence. However, after Alice's death, Gerald now totally changed his story and stated that he didn't kill Virginia, that it was, and the boys, that it was actually Alice who had done it, and that he had no idea where their bodies were, so that they weren't actually in the lake. That's just a story he said, mm-hmm. but he didn't know where they were.
Okay, if they're both locked up in jail, though... It's not like they're seeing each other or doing anything or having a relationship. Why would you wait till after she's dead? Like, she has no claim over you. Like, there's nothing. I don't even know if inmates can they communicate with each other? Like, I don't know if you can send letters from prison to prison like that.
I'm pretty sure. I don't think that they did have any communication because I got this information because Gerald ended up writing like kind of a memoir about himself. And he includes some of the stuff and that he wrote to the guy helping him write his memoir, and then also one of his lawyers. So, but okay. Yeah, he states that he had nothing to do with it, but that I think he knew it had happened when Alice returned. But Virginia, Richard, and Reagan's bodies have never been found, even though the lake was extensively searched. So you would think, because they were in oil drums.
Yeah.
Those would survive, but I don't really know how big that lake is.
And also too, like, depending on how long ago it was, like current, like things can get moved.
So 1980.
Yeah. But
so
I don't know. And then with
so 33 years.
And have we checked the mines? Because with how convenient that seemed to be for her the first time, Yeah. Who's to say if she did kill them, I would think that would be where she'd take the other bodies, would be to a mine.
Well, and then it did say in one, because, you know, you always articles give you different accounts of things, like kind of similar, but a little different. So one of them did say that Gerald at first put them in a mine shaft, but then took them out and then put them in the lake, which I thought was kind of weird. But
that is super weird.
So, but I think that, I mean, Alice would have worked at a ranch that had a lot of places that, I mean, possibly could, and she seems to know the area pretty well. So, I mean, it's a possibility that they could be down a mine shaft somewhere, and if there nobody's looking and nobody's going down those mine shafts, you probably aren't going to find them. So there is a burial plot for Virginia, Richard, and Reagan. And when Virginia's mom, Claire, died, her ashes, I think, were placed in that burial plot as well, so that if they are ever found, they will be reunited. But she died not knowing where her daughter and grandsons are. So I got a lot of my information for this from an article called Man Who Confessed to 1980 Murders Says He Didn't Do It by Claire McFarland, and to a book by Ron Francell called Alice and Gerald, A Homicidal Love Story. And then he also wrote an article called The Udens, An Elderly Couple's Homicidal Love Story. So those were my main sources, and there were a few others. I got some stuff from Murderpedia.
Okay.
So, interestingly, though, Murderpedia only had Alice and not Gerald. Oh,
interesting. So they don't seem to think he did it then.
Who knows? And who knows if he did or not? I mean, I don't know. Like, he didn't seem like that bad of a guy.
No. And what an interesting hold, if she did have that kind of hold on him, how interesting that he'd have to wait until she died to tell the truth or so, or change his story. Like, I don't know. That's just because, again, they can't talk to each other. They can't interact with each other. So what would it matter? Plus, they're elderly anyway. So it's like, she's going to be in prison forever, whether you say something or not. I don't know. It's just weird.
Yeah, because I think he's like 82 now.
Oh, my goodness.
And then, and the other thing that's so interesting is, like, they just kind of live normal lives after all of this happened. So, like, after Virginia, Richard, and Reagan disappeared or were murdered, they ended up just moving to Missouri and, like, just living normal lives in Missouri until all this came about. So until the knock on the door, 30 plus years later. And they both kind of just were like, okay. And Alice kind of talked about it being atonement. Like, she felt like they needed to be caught, which is probably why she kept telling everybody that she had murdered her husband. And like, she just was probably like waiting. Like, I can't believe nobody's come and arrested me for this. And and then they come and talk to her. And then it's still years later that they come and finally arrest her. Like 8 years after they talked to her about it. And they're like, oh, okay. And it just, the fact that everybody knew, but just because they didn't have a body for,
that's crazy.
15 years meant that they couldn't press charges.
Crazy. Well, thank you for that case. That was that had a lot of twists and turns in it.
I know. Now you can see why I had a hard time like writing it, because what are the odds of like a elderly couple, well, like just the story of like an elderly couple getting arrested for these murders, and like that murders do get solved even 40 years after they occur.
Yeah, but even too, how unfortunate that there's no, I guess, like if you believe in that sort of like the rest for those, for Virginia and her kids, like they're just somewhere and nobody knows really what happened, and there's no like evidence of like, because if you had the bodies you might be able to tell like, was it Alice or not, like I don't know.
Yeah, well, and like the blood in the station wagon, like they knew it was, they were pretty sure it was Virginia's, and so thinking that something like Claire, the mom, thought something had happened to Virginia, but she could just not fathom that somebody would do something to Virginia and the boys. So like they were on like all the missing persons and the Cody, I think it's called the Cody Project, where they look for missing children and missing exploited children. So they did like age progressions for the boys, and you know, to find out 33 years later that they died
that
day is really hard.
Yeah, I think that's like it would probably be very hard to lose someone, but I think it would be even harder to not know and to have all of those unanswered questions of like, why or what happened or where are they? Who did this? Like even to have somebody to be like, okay, this person did this. But in this situation, like you don't really know, like grandma died before knowing what happened. And even now we don't know who did it.
For sure who did it and where they are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you.
Yeah.
My story or my case this week also had a lot of twists and turns. And it's funny that you mentioned that author that you did, because he actually played a huge role in the case that I have today. Because he lives in Wyoming, or he's from Wyoming.
Yes, he's a well-known author from Wyoming.
Yeah. And so he did a lot of stuff about like cases, and specifically like this one, because he knew some of the people. So yes, his name's Fran Schell, right?
I think, yep.
And so he had a lot to play in this. And we'll talk about him again kind of at the end. But my case takes place September 24th, 25th, because it happens late at night. So September 24th, 1973, Rebecca or Becky Thompson, she was 18, and her 11-year-old sister, Amy Burridge, were out at a convenience store in Casper, Wyoming, buying some groceries. So this was around like 9 o'clock at night. Becky just decided like they were going to go grab some food and get some groceries, and asked if her younger sister wanted to go with her. So the girls got to the store, did their shopping, and as they headed back out to the parking lot around like 9:30-ish, they noticed that a tire on their car had gone flat. And so there was a call that Amy's mom ended up saying that two nice, in air quotes, men were going to give them a ride home. Turns out these two nice men named Ronald Leroy Kennedy, who was 27, and Jerry Lee Jenkins, who was 29, had slashed the tires. So they kind of set up this little meeting, because they had parked next to the car, slashed the tires, and waited for the girls to come out.
I kind of thought something nefarious had happened to the tire. Well, not just because we're doing true crime, but just being gone in a convenience store, how often does like your tire lose that air that quickly?
Yeah, and especially too, because it's like you were only in there for 30 minutes. It doesn't sound like there were many other people. There was like any other people around. So what could have possibly happened to your tire? Because this would mean that somebody had to have done something to it.
Yeah.
But again, this is Wyoming, and apparently Casper, Wyoming was this very safe, idyllic American town, right? This is the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
People didn't lock their doors and all that kind of stuff back in that day, which is, again, surprising because a lot of serial killers during this era. But
yeah,
it was
how many in Wyoming, though.
No, probably not too many. But it was like a safe community, right? So they didn't think anything of it. So after the girls had called their mom and said these guys were going to help them and give them a ride home, the men forced the girls at knife point into their Chevy Impala, and instead of driving them home, drove them to the Fremont Canyon Bridge, which I don't know if it's connected to the Fremont Lake that you were talking about.
Oh,
but either way, the Fremont Canyon Bridge was over this canyon that had like water underneath it. So the bridge is one lane, and it rises 112 feet above the North Platte River. So once they arrived, the men made Amy get out of the car, because this whole time they've been intimidating and threatening the girls. They held them at knife point. Statements say that Kennedy was kind of like taunting them with the knife, like he would stab the seats and stuff like that to kind of scare them. And Becky was begging that they don't hurt her sister, because she was only 11. So after they get to the bridge, they made Amy get out of the car. And as she did, she told her sister, "I love you, Becky." Becky pleaded with the men not to harm her sister, not to attack her. Becky ends up saying that she told them like not to rape her, but I don't know, the order of things is kind of jumbled, because I got a lot of my sources from different news articles. So from like the Washington Post, the LA Times, the New York Post, all of these different articles. So they all kind of had different variations of the story. And so Jenkins stayed in the car with Becky while Kennedy got out of the car with Amy, and he ended up throwing Amy over the side of the bridge. And after that, so it doesn't say that Becky knew that she was thrown over the bridge. She just assumed she was still outside. And the men took turns raping Rebecca and they beat her pretty badly. She was bruised. So the men then made her get out of the car and told her that she was going to be with her sister, and then tossed her over the side of the bridge as well. And the way that they describe the bridge is like there's like this narrow little gorge of the river before it like gets into a larger body of water. And so Amy had hit a rock near the riverbank, forcing her spine to be driven into her brain. So it's unlikely that she lived more than a few seconds after that. But Rebecca, when she was thrown over, she ended up hitting a ledge with her hip, which pushed her outward more. So she ended up in deeper water away from where a lot of the rocks were. Her hip was fractured in 5 places and it's dark. So remember, we're looking at maybe 10, 11 p.m. at night, like maybe even early morning, depending. I didn't really look at how far away these things were or again, how long they had her in the car, but it was really dark. So her hip was fractured, but she still managed, which is crazy to me, to swim to shore, like with her hip fractured that much. Props to that, because that's a lot of strength to ignore that. Your hip is definitely required to swim.
Yeah.
So when she got to shore, she still could hear their voices. So she didn't know, because before they threw her over the ledge, she heard them saying, like, we got to make sure that she's dead, that she dies.
Yeah.
So as she swam to shore, she ended up hiding in some like sagebrush that was nearby. And they, some reports even say that as much as it hurt, got herself into the fetal position, and she had really long dark hair. So she kind of covered her leg, her body with her hair in addition to the sagebrush to really make it so they couldn't see her. And so she was hearing them from above her and kept telling herself, like, don't fall asleep, don't go to sleep. She needed to be alert. When the sun started to rise, she couldn't really hear anything or even see anyone. She had tried to call out. One report said that she tried to call out for her sister. Other reports didn't say that, but she couldn't hear her sister at all. So she didn't know what was going on. And so she started to crawl her way up the rock slide, which again has like a lot of little rocks. Her hips are fractured. She's been out in the cold all night because it's September in Wyoming, so definitely very chilly, and she's wet. So she started to climb her way back up to the road for help. Yeah. And that's when an elderly couple, Carl and Dorothy Strasser, they were headed to the river to go fishing. They spotted her slumped on the side of the road. Rebecca was half naked from the waist down, bruised and bloody, probably still very wet and shivering on the side of the road. So she told them what happened as they drove her to a roadside market that was about 10 miles down the road. Once they arrived, they called the sheriff and an ambulance for Becky. She was able to describe the men who attacked her. She said one was skinny and dark haired with crazy eyes, and the other was chubby, pale, and greasy looking. She said that both men reeked of alcohol. And so the sheriffs knew immediately who she was talking about, because Kennedy and Jenkins both had troubled pasts. So they had a lot of run-ins with the law before. Both were in and out of correctional facilities from the time that they were very young. I tried to look up individual what their past was, and I couldn't really find anything other than in 1968, Jenkins had worked with Ron's brother, Jim. And together, Jim and Jenkins had raped a 19-year-old girl and were arrested for it. And so this was, 5 years before? And so Jim Kennedy went to prison, but unfortunately, during the trial against Jim, the witness was badgered so badly by the defense that she was hesitant and didn't end up coming back to testify against Jenkins. So he ended up getting off, which is interesting because I would think that just her testimony from the one case would, I don't know, maybe it's because I've watched Law and Order in the past, and I'm sure that is not at all how the law goes, but usually if there's a group, they're tried together, or even if they are tried separately, you would think that the test, it would go through both, but I don't know if anybody knows more about the laws.
Although don't you have a right as a defendant to face your accuser?
Oh, that is true. Is that like a constitutional right? I don't know.
I don't know. I just know. I'm pretty sure that's a thing.
Come on, Amber. You're the one who knows more about history than me.
That's true. But
I don't know. If you guys know, email us at stateofmurderpodcast@gmail.com.
Teach us law, please.
Teach us about the law.
Well, it's so frustrating because as we go state by state, every state has its own set of laws. So it's like, there's no way we're going to be knowledgeable about every state specifically.
Yeah.
Like California, we could, okay, maybe. But other than that, it's like, we're just shooting.
Yeah. And if the articles don't really tell us, then it's hard for us to know what's going on. So if you're from Wyoming, please let us know why the cases were separate. I don't know. So either way, Jenkins got off. He didn't have to serve any prison time. So now,
when that happened, do you know?
So he was, how old did I say he was? Because the other one was 27. He was 29. So it would have been 5 years before that. Okay, so he would have been what, like 24?
I thought maybe if he was like a minor.
No, he definitely still would have been in his 20s. So now Jenkins was working with Jim's younger brother, Ron, and the police were hot on their trail once the description was out. Again, total props to Becky for being able to remember those details, describe those guys, stay lucid. I feel like I probably would have passed out long before anyone would have been able to get information. That was great. So Sheriff Dave Davala and the other sheriffs in the department started a search for the men. So Jenkins was found quickly. It sounded like they said at laundry or doing laundry or something. So I would assume like maybe at a laundromat. And he was arrested. No one knew where Kennedy was, but they knew the car that he drove, the Impala. And so Sheriff Davala was driving around town just looking for him when suddenly he spotted the car and conveniently Kennedy was in it. So he arrested him and they started examining the car for evidence and they found blood, they found knife cuts, they found a bunch of evidence in there connecting him to the crime. They even had Becky do a lineup and she was able to identify both of them. So they're basically like, there's a lot of things stacked against them here. So during questioning, Jenkins confessed pretty quickly, but he said that Kennedy made him do it and that he just was going along with it, that they had been drinking. And so he didn't really know, like that wasn't like what they were planning on doing. And he just was going along with it because he was super drunk. Kennedy, on the other hand, stated that he absolutely had no idea what was going on. He's like, I don't know what happened to her, but you know what? You guys made a mistake. That's okay. You should let me go because I'm going to help you find who did this.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, sure.
Oh, and just so you know, it was this, it's the Sixth Amendment.
The Sixth Amendment. Okay, you looked it up. Okay.
Yeah.
Because I was like, that sounds like the Constitution right there. Like we have some sort of right to face our accuser. Okay. So during the trial, because obviously whether they denied it or not, the evidence was against them. So during the trial, the defense tried to claim insanity, citing that they had terrible childhoods. And that was why they had a lot of cruelty, crime-filled lifestyles. But that didn't fly because the legal definition for insanity is a mental illness of such a severe nature that a person cannot distinguish fantasy from reality. They cannot manage his or her own affairs, or they are subject to uncontrollable impulsive behavior. Whereas both of these men knew exactly what they were doing and they knew that it wasn't a fantasy, that it was reality. They seemed to be managing just fine on their own. And this didn't sound impulsive because they slashed the tires, they waited.
It was very premeditated.
Yeah. Even if it was only for a little bit, it was premeditated.
But they're like, we're going to do this to get this to happen to then this, do this.
Yeah. In less than 5 hours, the jury had their verdict. Kennedy and Jenkins were found guilty of first-degree murder, rape, assault, and battery. They were sentenced to death by gas chamber, and their date of execution was set for a year after the crime. During this course, however, their sentence was commuted to life in prison when in 1977, the Wyoming Supreme Court overturned the death penalty. This caused Becky to fear that her attackers would one day walk free and possibly even come back to kill her because she did testify against them. And obviously, like she was the one who survived. So she was able to tell them what was going on. Once their sentence was set to life, they were able to try appeal to get a retrial, appeal for parole, like where they were up for parole, all of these things. And even to Kennedy was appealing for a retrial later on. Becky went on to live her life, but always held on to the guilt of being the one who survived and being unable to save her younger sister.
Yeah.
She got married.
Sad.
I know. She got married in 1989 and even had Sheriff Davala, the guy who responded and ended up finding Kennedy, to walk her down the aisle when her stepdad couldn't because he was stuck like working on an oil rig and he couldn't come. So
that's really sweet.
Yeah. And so they remain close and in contact, like, because he was the one who came and he kind of saved her. She had a daughter despite having many complications during conceiving and then also like throughout the pregnancy and delivery because of the extensive injuries to her hip. And so she named her daughter Vale. She would be notified. Yeah, Vale, like V-A-I-L. Not like a veil, like a wedding
veil. Okay.
Vale, like, I don't know what the other spelling is. So she would be notified throughout her life every time the two men were up for parole. And she even ended up fighting adamantly to keep them locked up. So she had like petitions going to keep them locked up and to fight for them to not be eligible for parole anymore. Throughout that, like, again, that constant fear being brought up that they were going to get out and they were going to come back for her caused Becky to struggle with alcoholism and depression throughout her life. She ended up getting a divorce from her husband and sought therapy to, quote, be normal again, was what she would tell her therapist, that she just wanted, she didn't feel right again because of all, a lot of, she really held on to a lot of guilt that she survived this, and all the things that happened to her, totally understandably. That's something that stays with you.
Yeah, absolutely. So, especially because she was older and like she was supposed to take care of her little sister, and there was a significant age difference, 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty big.
It was her stepsister. Yeah. And then for her to still be so close, and then also too, because she was the one who asked her sister if she wanted to go with her. Yeah. So kind of like feeling that as well. So in 1992, Kennedy started an appeal for a retrial, and this frightened Becky. She was really afraid that he was going to get that retrial. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to find information. I couldn't really see anything about why or like what the grounds were for the retrial, but he found grounds to apply for a retrial. On July 31st, 1992, Becky, her daughter Vale, and her boyfriend at the time, who was never named in any articles, all it said was that he was a welder. They returned to the bridge where everything happened. Becky didn't really tell him why she wanted to go back. She got them in the car and they just started driving there. And so Becky talked to him about what had happened and how she felt, like, this is where it happened. This is where I fell. This is where I climbed up, like, to save myself. She was just kind of going through everything, which hadn't really happened too much before. Like, she had told people about it, but not gone back to the place where everything had happened. So she told him that she loved him, and she started to cry and become very upset as she got towards the end of the story. Her boyfriend didn't want her daughter to get upset hearing her mom cry. So he got up and he told her, like, I'm going to go put her in the car and we can keep talking, because Becky was just sitting at the edge of the bridge. So while he was walking to the car, he heard a crash in the water below. And Rebecca, who was 37, he couldn't find her. So he started yelling and calling for her, saying, just say something. Where are you? I can't see you. I think it was closer towards the evening. So it was like getting darker, if I remember right, where they were at. So he couldn't really see her, if she was still there or what. And he was still holding on to her daughter. So then she started crying because everyone's freaking out. She doesn't know what's going on.
Yeah.
When police arrived, they ruled out foul play and found her body about an hour later near the same spot where Amy had been found. She suffered a broken neck and massive head injuries, resulting in her death, very similar again to how Amy was found. Sheriff Davala was notified. He was actually doing, like, he was at a fair or some type of event going on when they notified him that they found a body in the river, and he just knew that it was her. And so to this day, nobody knows if she jumped or slipped or what she was even thinking going out there, like what her processes were. They can only speculate because she didn't say anything. She didn't do anything.
Yeah.
So and his back was turned. So they don't know if, like, maybe she was just standing up to the edge to look down and fell, whether she just let herself go, like what happened. Rebecca's ashes were buried on top of Amy's casket. So that way she could be with her sister again. And the day she died, Kennedy's appeal was also denied, and the lawyer was going to call her like that Monday. It didn't say what day that July 31st was. I didn't look up what day of the week it was. I want to say it was like a Friday, and the lawyer didn't have her number with him, so was going to call her on Monday to let her know that his appeal was for a retrial was denied, so he wasn't going to get one. So Jerry Jenkins would die on October 29th, 1998 of heart failure while he was still incarcerated. So he was 54 years old. And Kennedy is the only one involved in this who is still alive. So he's 73 years old right now and still serving his life sentence. He's declined any interviews with newspapers or TV or anything like that. Because I also watched a brief documentary that's on YouTube called Innocence Lost. And it's about this, and they're talking to the author of the book and the sheriff and stuff. So that's where I got some of his knowledge.
Yeah.
To this day, Kennedy isn't talking to anybody about anything. Although he did eventually write a memoir, but I couldn't find it anywhere. So I don't know if it's just like
a nobody wants to read that. Part.
Yeah.
Nobody cares what you gotta say, asshole.
Yeah, especially because he's thriving in prison, earning privileges such as being able to keep a pet, dating, and eventually even earn conjugal visits with his new wife.
Oh, God. This is the thing that irritates me beyond anything. What the fuck is wrong with people who are like, yes, let me get involved with this murderer and marry? Yeah. I know that there are some mental health things that trigger that, but it's, oh my God.
I couldn't find anything on what his wife's name was or who she was or like what the situation was, but yeah. And it's just so unfortunate because Becky had to suffer for so long and died at age 37, and this Jagoff gets to live to be 73 and still living. I looked it up like on their Wyoming's inmate lookup thing, because none of all the articles that I read were older, from closer to when she had committed suicide, and then also early 2000s, 2010s, they were bringing it up. But yeah, so I looked up the inmate looker to see if he was still alive at that point, because last time they one of the only article that cited his age at still being alive was like 67. So yeah, he's still alive. And then I tried to see if it would let me know like any other information about him, and it didn't. So that is the unfortunate case of Becky Thompson and Amy Burridge. I mean, hopefully.
Do we know anything about her daughter now? Did
you say in the article, the same one that hadn't been updated when Kennedy was 67 said that she lives in Chicago now. She's in her 30s, and she's, I mean, as far as I could tell, she has a family over there in Chicago. It didn't really give too much, but hopefully she's doing well and hanging in there after this tragedy. I think it just upset me even more because I'm like, oh, he gets to be happy in prison and they had to suffer. And just even too, because when I read the coroner, kind of their comments on the fact that Amy couldn't have lived more than a few seconds, even that has to be so painful. To know she's gonna die, like to fall and then to have the injuries that she does, even a second of pain is not deserved by these two girls. No. And Becky was a woman when she died, but it's heartbreaking. And then it just sucks because it doesn't really feel like, they're in prison, but to hear that they're that one guy's thriving is just such a slap in the face. Like, you should be suffering for what you did. Yeah. But I mean, I guess some justice. Jenkins finally went to jail for it and he ended up having a heart attack.
Yeah.
But still, it just sucks because they were supposed to be put to death like a year later and they weren't. He got to find a wife and keep a pet, which it did not specify was an animal pet or just like a weird prison pet, like a person.
Like a spider?
Or no, like a person, like another person, like that's their pet. I don't know. It didn't say.
I go to Spider and you're like, no, like his little man.
like a man on the side. Like he's allowed to do that. Because how do you date in prison?
I don't know. Letters, I guess. I don't know.
See, the only dating I know is from Orange is the New Black, where they all were in relationships with each other. So
yeah, that's true.
That's where my mind went when I heard pet. I just heard, I don't know. That's how you know I've been watching too much Law and Order SVU.
I'm thinking, oh, maybe they have a prison dog program.
Well, that's what, the second time I read it, I'm like, oh, maybe he got to keep, because I know some programs, like they have like inmates, they give them like cats or dogs, like to raise because it helps teach them empathy because they're caring for something else. But I don't know. This dude doesn't sound like he has much empathy.
He just had, and then the other thing is like going back to his first time he was arrested for rape, excuse me, how long was he in prison? Because he didn't seem to go to prison for that long. If 5 years later,
that was Jenkins, the guy who died of the heart attack, not Kennedy.
Kennedy's the other
Kennedy
one.
Well, Kennedy, there's two Kennedys. So his brother went to jail. Jim went to jail for the rape, but Ron is in jail now. Yeah. And it didn't say whether his brother got out or where, if
they're even in the same prison. So his brother rapes a girl and then he rapes and murders a little girl, rapes her sister. Like, what is up with that family? Shit.
Yeah. Well, that's what they said. That's why they tried to go for the insanity, saying it was something in their childhoods. I really tried to look up like what it was that happened in their childhood. Like, were they abused? Were they in home? It didn't say. It just said that they said they had sucky childhoods and they were in and out of correctional facilities from the time they were young. It didn't even give me an age on when they started getting into trouble. But I mean, so much so that the sheriffs immediately knew who she had described because they knew these guys were hanging around and they knew who they were. So I don't know. It's just, it sucks when, yeah, you get some kind of justice because he's in jail, but I kind of don't like that he gets to just, I guess, live his life in jail. Like, he gets married and he gets a date and he gets to take care of a pet.
Yeah. Well, and even with Jenkins, it's like, why wouldn't he learn? Like, he was shit lucky the first time. And then to, like, get involved in something very similar again.
But again, too, like, we don't know, maybe he really was just kind of a stooge for both of these brothers. Like, maybe was just, hey, like, they got drunk, he was just trying to have a good time, and then he just was going along with what the brothers did. Like, because it says that Kennedy, Ron Kennedy, the one who's in prison now, he was the one who had the knife and who were threatening the girls repeatedly while Jenkins. So I don't know. It sounds like he was more of the aggressor in a lot of stuff. And he was the one who threw Amy over the bridge. It doesn't say whether it was one or both of them who threw Becky over, but
okay.
I mean, he was the one who ended up throwing.
Yeah, that's true.
Which again has to be like, she's 11, dude. Ugh. Like, and you threw her over a bridge.
Yeah, he's a real piece of shit.
Yeah. So
Thank you for sharing that story. That was heartbreaking. When you started talking about her driving back up to the bridge with her boyfriend, I was like, oh, nothing good is coming of this reminiscence.
Yeah. So. And why I kind of wanted to backtrack on the article, on the guy, because his name is Ron as well, right? The author, Ron Francell. Yeah. In all the articles I found, I was kind of disappointed that even in the documentary, like, it was only a 30-minute documentary on YouTube, they kept talking more about him than what happened. And I was kind of, I mean, I get it. I don't know. And then because he wrote a book about it and I had wanted to read it because it sounded very interesting. And like, that would probably have a lot of the details I needed.
Yeah.
But because of coronavirus, there are no libraries open and Amazon is taking a million years to get things to us. So it wouldn't have gotten to me until next month. So I didn't have time to read the book. So maybe this is something that we'll revisit later on when I do know more, but it was just so unfortunate to see that, great for that guy. Like, he wrote the book and he's doing justice to them. But the fact that all the articles were mainly focusing on him, and even the documentary, when they talked to him, in that 30-minute documentary, they talked partially to him and then partially to the sheriff. All of the information I got was pretty much from the sheriff, because whenever they were talking to the author, he was just talking about his experience and like how he grew up and how it did. And which is important to know, that the town was like a safe community. And then when this happened, all of a sudden this town was shook and it was like, kids were on curfews and people were scared to let their kids out and like out of their sight and be around, because to think that something like this would happen in their town, which again is important to note, but if you're doing a documentary trying to talk about this case, then I felt like it was a little disrespectful. Like, I don't know. That's just my personal opinion, that they didn't spend much time, aside from the sheriff, talking about what actually happened to these girls. And that's really what it's about. And that's, I think, kind of reminded me of why I wanted to do the podcast. And I think why you wanted to do too, because we want to let people know about these victims, because they're not given a lot of the time that others are. And it's important to keep, I think, their stories going and keep that awareness that these things happen and they're very unfortunate. These victims shouldn't be forgotten and it should be acknowledged that, I mean, because from what it sounded like Amy was a tomboy. She liked to play outside and she's a real active girl. Same thing with Becky. She was very outgoing. The author even shared that, because he knew them in the neighborhood, like, that she was one of the nicer teenager. Like, she would even talk to like the younger kids, and she was just really friendly, and just overall they were great girls. And it's really unfortunate when things like this happen. And I think we talk about it most weeks now, but so important, the like getting mental health services to the people that need it. And I think in this instance, not just the criminals, because we do want to try to prevent that, but also too, having like getting the help to Becky. Like, she was in some therapy, but I think maybe if it had started sooner than that, because it sounds like she did it after her divorce, whereas like, and maybe again because of the time period that this took place, like therapy was still very stigmatized, but if it had been like getting her the help right after the incident and sticking with it and helping her through that, then things might have been different, you know?
Yeah, having more victims' rights, victim advocacy, and like just helping, definitely helping them through, because like that's a lot of trauma to have happen. And even though we don't know if she fell or if she jumped, she obviously, that really was weighing on her, and just the idea of like confronting him again like was weighing on her. So yeah, that's really
and then
sad.
To be reminded of that over and over every time she has to be told that they're up for parole, it's like you're getting attacked all over again. Like, you're just having to forcing these people to be back in your head constantly.
Yeah. So I think when I, with the author that we're talking about, Francelle, I did read most of the book, and like the issue I did also have talking about victims and everything is because like his writing obviously is coming from a lot of Gerald and Alice. And so the picture he paints of Virginia isn't, not that we need to always paint every victim in glowing lights, because that's not realistic, but like was kind of derogatory a lot of times, and painted her as like as unattractive, chubby, kind of like that she couldn't handle life and everything. And there just wasn't a lot, like there wasn't a lot of positive about her. So like that, I think, was a lot of my struggle with writing this story, was that I was like, there wasn't a lot of positive information. There was a lot of information about Gerald and Alice, because I mean, it's an interesting case that these elderly people are all of a sudden arrested. But I wanted to know more about like the boys and Virginia, and there wasn't a lot other than like the boys were hyperactive and hard to manage, and she was at her wit's end and couldn't take care of the kids and wasn't a good mom. But where he's getting that information, it does say he interviews a ton of people, so maybe that is just the truth about it. But
yeah, but if she's just getting it from the people that killed her, then it's not the most reliable source
from her,
of character.
From her ex-husband. But I mean, it could be true, and it, maybe it's, you know, just a different color lens for her. But you know, we do talk about, like, when we talk about Daddy, we were talking, you were a couple of episodes ago, when you're like, oh, I wonder what somebody would say about me if, you know, when I die, what they would say about me. And so it's like, hard to believe that there wasn't anybody that was like, oh, you know, she was really funny or outgoing, or so I just had a hard time with that. But it was actually a really well written book. So he draws a really good picture. So,
okay. So, yeah. So, I mean, hopefully I will get to read that book, because I still want to read it. I still want to kind of know more about what's going on, but it's just unfortunate with everything going on that I couldn't get it before this episode. All right. So now it's time for our segment of super fun state facts
and cities.
All right. I have the state fact this week for Wyoming is that it is one of six states that has a state dinosaur. And so Wyoming state dinosaur is the Triceratops, and it is their state dinosaur because there was a specimen of Triceratops skull collected in 1888. In the Lance Formation of Wyoming, and they had originally thought it was another species called the Ceratops, which is just like one horn on the head, because when they saw the skull poking out, they tried to get it, and they, like, one of the horns broke off, and so they were like, oh, here you go, like, this is a Ceratops. But when they really prepped the site and looked at it, they realized that it had three horns on its head, and so they named it the Triceratops. Actually, like, a lot of the Triceratops remains were found in Wyoming, Colorado, South Dakota, Montana, like that whole area. And so that is a Wyoming state dinosaur, is the Triceratops.
The Triceratops. Hey, shout out. You know, I was just thinking, what if you didn't know dinosaurs existed? Because I mean, they had to, there was a time and that happened.
When they didn't know.
And like, all of a sudden you see this huge giant skull.
Like, with like three horns on its head.
I would be like, what the hell is this? Is this around here now?
I know. I'm like, what kind of animal did this come from? Oh my God. I know. And a Triceratops, but can you imagine finding like a T-Rex skull? Like, oh, the thing's huge. I'd be like, oh my God. Although I don't know where the T-Rex was found. So if anyone knows that, like,
I have no idea. I was never super into dinosaurs.
Really? Oh, well, I was super into dinosaurs because Jurassic Park came out when I was a kid and that was like a huge thing. And so, I mean, dinosaurs were always pretty cool. There was even, my brother had a dinosaur book growing up that had like, it was like one of those little like encyclopedia type ones that talked about the different dinosaurs. And, there was a dinosaur named the Riojasaurus. So we thought that was really cool because that's
your family's dinosaur.
Yeah, the Riojasaurus. It looked kind of like, why can't I think of the name? Brontosaurus? Are those the ones with the really long neck?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, so it looked kind of like that. Like it was from that. Yeah, so fun fact about me. Riojasaurus. Mm-hmm.
I wonder why they wonder what that means. What's Riojas mean?
I don't know. I know that it's a region in Spain. The Rioja region is in Spain. There's a winery there. My dad tried some of their, they make wine. There's like a winery called the Rioja Winery. So I think that might be where our name came from. I don't know.
Oh, okay. Gosh, know your family history.
I know. I'm sorry.
All right. I have to remember, you're not into history.
Nope, not even. A little bit. I talked to my dad today about the OK Corral fact that you gave the other
day.
And he was like, yeah, the OK Corral, it lasts like 30 seconds. I'm like, okay, like that's just something people know, I guess. Like looking at me like I'm crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. Come on, Selena. No American history. Jesus.
No.
Get your shit together.
No.
Do you want to do your city fact first or you want me to?
Sure. I knew my city fact. So the city that this case took place in was Casper. And so I was trying to find some facts that were unique about Casper. And really the thing that kept coming up was it was the location of the Sand Creek Massacre, which was where the Cheyenne and Arapaho Indians were, I guess, massacred by the U.S. Army. It occurred from November 29th, 1864, when a 675-man force attacked and destroyed a village of Cheyenne and Arapaho people in a territory, killing and mutilating an estimated 150 to 500 Native Americans, about two-thirds of whom were women and children.
Mm.
So that sucks, and I'm sorry that I could not find a funner fact for Casper. I mean, I get, because it was either that.
A little genocide.
to remind you that we're Americans. God damn it.
I was watching, just talking about, like, how terrible some of our U.S. stuff is, but I was watching an episode of Top Chef. It's Top Chef Boston, so it's an old season, but I'm rewatching some Top Chef because I love Top Chef. And so they were celebrating the first Thanksgiving, and so they had some Native Americans sitting with some descendants of people that had been on the Mayflower, and I was just like, I found it disturbing and gross. And I was just like, what the hell is this? And I mean, this season was like, I want to say like 6 years ago, but I'm like, can we be a little more woke, please?
Yes, please.
And not be like, let's bring the Native Americans and the ancestors of the Mayflower together.
I know. Like,
I was super uncomfortable watching the episode.
Yeah. It's, it's always an uncomfortable thing. And I think, I don't know, I feel like as in American history, and hopefully it's changing now, I don't know, because I haven't been in school for a while, but hopefully it's changing in the fact that we're, even when we're talking about American history, we're getting a little bit more into Native history and other things. Because I remember like being in school and you really learn about like European history, and then all of a sudden you're in American history and it's like, yeah, we got this land, and oh, you're hearing all of these things. What is the Louisiana Purchase and all these things, and you're hearing about this, but nobody ever really talks about what that meant. Like, what does that entail? Well, it entails a lot of massacres and a lot of like blankets with smallpox and a lot of like
absolutely
very horrible treatment of Native Americans. And I feel like as a country, we should be, now I'm going off on a side tangent, sorry everyone
that's okay.
who's listening, but that it should be more known, because in Germany, like in their schools, they learn about the atrocities of the Holocaust, and they learn about that because it's important to know that, I mean, our history isn't perfect. We're not a perfect nation, and there are things that have happened in our past that were wrong and that should be addressed and not just pretended like they didn't happen. And don't even get me started on slavery. Like,
yeah.
People,
or even, like, I mean, even when we look at how Mexico and the United States and where Mexico is, and like the fact that like people who live here, and it's like, no, where are you from? And it's like, from here, because California used to be Mexico, Texas used to be Mexico, New Mexico used to be Mexico.
Yeah, so like a lot of the West used to be Mexico.
And that, I just, like, every time somebody says that, I want to bang my head against the wall, because I'm like, no, they are from here. We,
Yeah. So we can go off forever about that, but that's not what this podcast is about.
My podcast about our anchor.
About
freaking injustice in America. Yes.
But just to throw in a fact about this massacre, the Sand Creek Massacre was referenced in Iron Man 3. For anyone who's seen that, I'm a huge fan of Marvel movies, so that's interesting. I mean, it was mentioned in Iron Man 3 where it's, so anyone who hasn't seen it, there's a villain called the Mandarin, and he talks about other crimes and stuff and massacres, and he's just referencing it. He's kind of like a terrorist figure. Well, he is a terrorist figure. And so when he hacks the media, he references the Sand Creek Massacre when he's trying to threaten and explain other killings that happen in Iron Man 3. So there you go. The Mandarin mentions it.
All right.
Sorry, Casper, Wyoming.
I'm sure there's a lot of fun, interesting, happy facts about Casper, Wyoming.
And if you know them, tell me, and we will add it to the bed. No, I'm saying, like, if anyone's listening from Casper, Wyoming, and fun fact, you email us and we will put it on our website, and we'll talk about it. Yes.
So yet again, like, I feel like when I pick my true crime stories, that I don't, I mean, maybe I should take into consideration the fun fact city, because like I keep picking like the smallest towns imaginable. So where this takes place, Lander and Hudson, like, they both have 450, 658 or something like that people in them. So very, very small. So,
hey, but that's a fun fact in itself.
That is a fun fact in itself. Small towns have quite the charm. I'm not saying that that's not true. There's a lot of great things in small towns, a lot of great people. But so I found this fact that outside of Lander, 15 miles outside of Lander, is the Sacagawea Cemetery, where it's believed that Sacagawea was buried. So hopefully people know who Sacagawea is.
She helped Lewis and Clark?
Yes. Yes, she did, Selena. She helped Lewis and Clark.
See, I know history. Thanks, Matt, at the museum. I'm just kidding. I knew that before night. I totally knew that before night at the museum.
Okay. So it's actually located kind of out by Fort Washisaki. Washisaki, he was a chief, I believe, from the Arapaho and Shoshone tribes. Yeah, so there's a cemetery out there where you can go and visit what they believe is Sacagawea's burial site. which is kind of interesting. Yeah. So I think that's kind of a cool thing to have outside of Lander, Wyoming.
Yeah, that is pretty cool. Also, too, both of our fun facts had to do with Native Americans. I wonder if there is like a pretty decent Native American population in Wyoming, or is it?
Oh yeah, there are because there's a lot of, I think, reservations.
Okay, because that's why I was like, are there?
Don't even get me started on that.
Yeah.
So
again, another podcast. That's for another podcast.
I have a lot of opinions about reservations. I'm from Nebraska, and they're not positive on what's happening to Native Americans and United.
Generally, when you tell a people that your land or their land is now your land, but they can have this little piece of it.
And it's like the shitty piece of land that could be found. Oh. And then they're like, oh, just kidding, because there's gold there. Move your asses.
Yep. Bye. Okay, we'll go off on American history another time.
Yes, I'm sure we will when we get to the South.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I glossed over on my story today. Gerald's family is his family roots are very Southern, and he's from a very anti-Semitic family. I'm not going to talk about that.
Oh my goodness.
They're from Nebraska. I don't want to mention that.
Oh my gosh.
I was making just decisions. I was like, I have enough. I don't need to tell about that.
Yeah.
It's bad enough as it is.
Yes. All right. So next week we are headed up north to the state of Montana. Right? That's what's next? Montana is above Wyoming.
I have a lot of love for Montana. So
spoiler alert, not a state I've been to.
Spoiler alert, I have been to Montana, and I will probably give you a lot of movie facts next week about Montana, because some of my favorite movies take place in Montana. I'm not going to tell you this week what it is.
No, we gotta save it. They got to come back next week.
Yeah, so cliffhanger, what's Amber's favorite movie?
Spoiler alert, the movie cliffhanger. Just kidding, it's not.
So if you want to know, listen to next week's podcast on Montana.
Woohoo! All right, so thank you for listening. We really appreciate it. Thank you to all of our new listeners. Welcome. It's been great having you here. So if you have any corrections or any fun facts you want to share or anything just saying hi, then email us at stateofmurderpodcast@gmail.com. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at SOM Podcast. And also, we are available pretty much wherever you get podcasts. So make sure you follow and subscribe to those, so that way you can stay up to date every time we drop a new episode, which is every Thursday. I know we were a little late on New Mexico's, just by a few hours. So sorry to everyone who is overseas and the time difference about that. You had to get it later. All right. So, thank you guys again, and have a great day/night whenever you're listening to us.
And we'll see you next week.
All right. Bye.
Bye.